From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. Five years ago, when NHPR first went on the air, New Hampshire poet Maxine Cumin had already been living full-time on her old hill farm in Warner for 6 years and was inspired to write this. Something went crabwise across the snow this morning. Something went hard and slow over our hayfield. It could have been a raccoon lugging a knapsack. It could have been a porcupine carrying a tennis racket. It was 1982. Cumin had just published her seventh book of poetry called Our Ground Time Here Will Be Brief and was serving in the venerable position as the nation's consultant in poetry to the Library of Congress, a post later called the U.S. Poet Laureate. Since then, Cumin has been one of the leading poetic voices of New Hampshire life, and even though the state has changed dramatically over the past quarter century, her writing continues to tie us to this place we call the Granite State. Today in The Exchange, it's our 25 and 25 series, and Maxine Cumin is the guest. We'll look at her long career as a New Hampshire woman of letters and get her poet's eye on how the Granite State has changed over the past 25 years. Join us with your calls. The Exchange number is 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR. Emails are welcome too. Please keep them brief. The address, exchange@nhpr.org. And Maxine Cumin, it's always great to have you in our studios. Thanks for coming in.
Oh, it's my pleasure, Laura. It's always fun to be with you.
Well, I outlined a little bit about where you were 25 years ago, but anything else, Maxine, we should add to that about what your life was like, what you were doing 25 years ago?
Well, it was kind of hectic because I was serving still at the Library of Congress, that post that was named Poet Laureate, I think, the following year. I was still the consultant. And as I was telling you before we went on the air, I took a horse down with me, a young mare, and kept her in Potomac, Maryland with a friend. And I went out every morning in my truck against the traffic out the George Washington Parkway and fed and watered and groomed and rode my young horse. And then I got back in the truck and barreled back into Washington, and there was no traffic at all because it was 10 o'clock by then. So, and then I was racing back to Warner, flying back virtually every weekend.
Coming back to the farm every weekend from D.C.
Yes, to come back to the farm.
What did they say when you said, I'll be the poet laureate, but I want to bring my horse?
I don't think I asked. It didn't seem to have any, I mean, it was not during the hours when I was being the poet laureate, so it seemed perfectly normal to me to bring a young horse that I was just beginning to school. She was 4 years old.
And you wanted to school her your way.
Well, I didn't want to spend a whole year away from her. That was it.
What does a poet laureate do, Maxine?
A poet laureate can do virtually whatever the poet laureate wants.
Sounds like a good gig.
It is a good gig. But some poets did hardly anything. Howard Nemiroff, for example, was very active with the high school English teachers, which was that was a real gift that he gave. And what I did was invite a whole bunch of Washington writers, poets and writers, essayists, novelists, and so on, who had, you know, already published reputations. And I invited them to bring a disciple or a mentee, as we now say, for our Thursday brown bag lunches in the poetry room. It's rather gorgeous room, beautifully furnished in Victorian furniture. And here we all were sitting on the floor with our brown bag lunches. And the brown bag lunches would run until 4 o'clock some days. So I did do that. I also had an opportunity to invite a number of women poets to read who had never read there before. And then I had to introduce people who came to read, some of them, including Czesław Miłosz. That was a big occasion because backstage we talked about, of all things, mushrooms, because we had the same language. The Latin terms are the same, whether you're speaking Polish or English.
Well, and we'll talk a little bit later about the farm and how it's inspired your work and poetry and so forth. But a little bit about New Hampshire back then in 1982, Maxine.
Did it feel like
a different place? Yeah.
Warner certainly was a different place. When we first came to Warner, when we moved in permanently, we had been using this old farmhouse for many years before that. But in 1976, well, whenever the first election primary was, we asked for Democrat ballots. It was as if we were communists. Now, of course, it's about 50-50, maybe even 60-40 in Warner. And Warner has grown. It was a tiny town then. I don't know how many, but it's, I would say it perhaps has almost doubled in size. People are much more aware. They are much more civic-minded, much more active. I mean, I find a now. Big change now over a kind of insular or parochial mentality before.
Now, that's real interesting because sometimes the lament you hear is, no one cares anymore, we're all bowling alone, but you're saying just the opposite.
I see more volunteerism and more activity in our town than existed before. There are the Citizens for Smart Growth who are trying to contain the big box developers who would like to take over a stretch of 103, which is, you know, the lower, actually it's the upper part of Warner. There's Warner Connects, another organization that's working to pull people together. And as you probably already know, because you were gifted with that gorgeous tomato, we have a couple of the biggest organic farmers in the area. All the way up on the mountain in the Gore, we have Bob Bauer and his wife, Jennifer. And then halfway down Kearsarge Mountain, we have Larry Pletcher, who's doing an enormous job. I mean, he's leased land in Boscawen. I mean, he's growing thousands of pounds of potatoes.
Well, then I want to let the audience know that Maxine Kuman brought me in a tomato before we started. And this is one of the things that you mentioned in your questionnaire, the 25 and 25 questionnaire that we ask everybody who's participated in this series. One of the things you have noticed is the growth of organic farming
yes.
here in New Hampshire.
Yes.
And in fact, one of our coming 25 and 25 guests will be Steve Taylor, the Commissioner of Agriculture. So I know he's going to talk more about that. But a little bit more on the changes that you've seen, Maxine, in New Hampshire. As you know, New Hampshire has become one of the most affluent states in the country. How do you think that has changed the landscape, the people, and so forth?
Well, of course, I'm probably not the best person to ask that question because I'm situated, as you know, far from the madding crowd, and I don't observe very much of that. I don't see big changes in the ways that my neighbors are living. I haven't seen any Mac mansions go up in Warner or Sutton or Bradford, the surrounding towns. I teach in the low residency MFA program in Henniker at New England College twice a year, and I haven't seen any giant changes in Henniker either. So maybe I'm just not observant enough.
Or maybe you're observing different things than the rest of us.
I think maybe that's it. Yeah.
And speaking of observing and the poet and how he or she, in your instance, sees things, what's the role of the poet, Maxine, in presenting a sense of place like New Hampshire? You know, what this place is all about, what its deeper meanings might be?
Well, I think the poet is very closely tied to place. And place is probably the major subject for the poet. And for that matter, for writers like William Wetherill or Ernie Hebert, I can name several others as well. However, over the last 10 or 15 years, I have become so much more political. And I never thought this would happen to me because I never thought that it was particularly the poet's place to express these feelings. But my new book, Still to Mow, has a whole section of poems called Please Pay Attention, which are essentially poems about torture. And I was asked there was a do at the Boston Public Library not too long ago, and I was asked there why I had written these poems. And I said, I didn't really write them. They were wrung from me because my anguish is so enormous, I could not help but write them. And yet I reflect back to the Vietnam War when my friend Denise Levertov, probably the most gorgeous lyric poet of our time, began writing anti-war poems, angry anti-war poems, and went to demonstrations, et cetera, et cetera. And at that time, I thought, she's throwing her voice away.
Really? You thought that?
I really did.
Because I've noticed your poems have gotten political as of late.
I have gotten very
political.
Jack,
your last book and the new book, Still to Mill.
Yeah. Well, I've evolved. I hope it's an evolution. I really am not in control of it. The poet has to write what the poet sees and what the poet feels. I think that's the poet's role. Maybe to ring the alarm bell. I'm going to participate in the events about Longfellow that University of Maine and the Historical Society are doing, and I'm going to talk about his poems against slavery. So you see, even then, in the middle of the 19th century, here is a poet who was a lyricist and a narrative poet and a populist, a poet of the people, and yet he is moved to write these. There are about seven or eight of them, and they're quite graphic and quite dramatic. So I think, to say nothing of Yeats's The Second Coming or Auden's poem, September 1, 1939, the first day of the Second World War when the Germans entered Poland. And there's Auden saying, I sit in one of the dives on 52nd Street, talking about this low, dishonest decade.
So you're following in that tradition.
I feel it. Yeah, exactly.
Right. After a very short break, more with Maxine Kuhman, and she's going to read from some of her poetry, her newest book, Still to Mow. So stay with us.
I'm Bill Martell. I live in Bedford. As a frequent guest on The Exchange with Laura Canoia, I've always been taken that Laura is an absolutely superb interviewer. I think one of the very best I've ever dealt with, and I would say that in terms of her interviewing skills and the ability to run an objective, neutral, balanced, but yet inquisitive kind of talk show, really is a national asset. I don't know if the people of New Hampshire realize that, just how good she is in terms of conducting interviews on such a wide range of issues, and the level of preparation is always superb, and the climate within the on the show is always one that just encourages free inquiry, free discourse and ideas, and it really is something that I think and hope the people of New Hampshire realize just what they have.
If you value The Exchange, we hope you'll take a moment to show your support by helping to pay for the program you count on. Just call 1-888-805-6477. Good morning. I'm Brady Carlson, the webmaster at New Hampshire Public Radio, here with our Morning Edition host, Lisa Peeks, and we're taking a moment during The Exchange to invite you to show your support for this program. We're hearing a great conversation with Laura and Maxine Kuhman, one of America's most celebrated poets and, of course, a New Hampshire resident. It's part of the 25 and 25 series, and that's what you support as a member of NHPR. Now, Lisa, you know we have a goal this morning for some matching funds that we have $5,000 in matching funds available this morning. But first, we have to raise $15,000, and our deadline is noon.
How are we doing on that?
We're doing pretty good. We now have less than $9,000 left to raise. So your contribution right now will help us stay on track to meet this important goal. $5,000 up for grabs.
That's fantastic. So you can get a call in right now. We'll be going back to Maxine Kuhman and Laura Canoia on The Exchange. But the number to call is 1-888-805-6477 or pledge online at nhpr.org. Maybe listen to NHPR online. It's very easy and convenient just to go to nhpr.org wherever you are. We hope that when you're there, you'll make a generous pledge of support and help us get closer to this $5,000 that's available. So it's as though your pledge of $500 is worth $5,500. So you have a chance to make your dollars count even more. I want to thank Judy Kalish of Spofford, who says she cannot imagine life without public radio. She is devoted voted. If you are too, call now and support the station.
1-888-805-6477 is the number to call. If you're in front of your computer, you can pledge online at nhpr.org. And this hour, we have a special thank you gift. At the $75 contribution level, we will send you a copy of the newest book of poems by Maxine Kuman. It's called Still to Mow, and Laura and Maxine are going to be talking a bit about that during this hour on The Exchange. Your support helps pay for this kind of thoughtful conversation about ideas, about the long term, the bigger picture of New Hampshire. And at the $75 contribution level, not only can you get that book, but you can help support this public radio service that you get every day on The Exchange. Call now at 1-888-805-6477.
Maxine Kuman is appearing today as part of our 25 and 25 series. New Hampshire Public Radio is 25 years old, and we decided what a great way to celebrate by getting the 25 top newsmakers, the people who have really made a difference in this state over those 25 years. And listener input is how we came up with that list. Another example of how NHPR listens to you and how there is a feedback mechanism involved. We don't just put it all out without getting support and continuous feedback from listeners. Of course, the best way to make your feedback known today is by making a pledge of financial support while NHPR has a great matching opportunity available. Call 1-888-805-6477 or go to nhpr.org. It's quick.
And it's easy. Just when you make that contribution, you know that you're contributing to the future of New Hampshire Public Radio. Just as New Hampshire has changed over the past quarter century, NHPR has grown over the past quarter century to expand, bring you better news coverage, to bring you more topics of interest, bring you special series like 25 and 25 here on The Exchange, to put new transmitters across the state so that you're better informed. Your contribution is what makes that happen. Help keep NHPR strong by calling 1-888-805-6477.
Don't forget, for a $75 pledge, you'll get a copy of Still to Mow, poems by Maxine Kuman, Laura Kanoi's guest this morning. That's a $75 level, and there are just 10 of those available, so call and get one.
Additional support for New Hampshire Public Radio comes from the Dairyfield School, a college preparatory day school in Manchester for students in grades 6 through 12. Admission open house November 18th. Information online at dairyfield.org. And from Bruss Construction, thoughtfully constructing sustainability design projects for over 25 years. Online at brusscon.com. This is NHPR.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoi. Today in The Exchange, it's our 25 in 25 series, where we celebrate NHPR's 25th birthday this year by talking with 25 Granite Staters who've shaped our state over the past quarter century. Today, the guest is Pulitzer Prize-winning writer and poet Maxine Kuman. We've been looking at how the Granite State has changed through the words and the eyes of our poets. We'll take your phone calls, too, of course. The Exchange number, 1-800-892-6477. Emails are welcome too, exchange@nhpr.org. Again, the number 1-800-892-6477. If there's been particular work by Maxine Kuman that has moved you, give us a call. Maxine, I want to ask you about your own New Hampshire experience. As you said earlier, by 1982, 25 years ago, you'd already lived full-time in the Granite State for about 6 years, part-time for, you know, at least 12
since
or 15 years.
Yeah,
since 63. What brought you here to that hill farm in Warner that you write so eloquently about?
We were just looking for a place to use as a weekend place. And we had each just received $5,000 in insurance policies from grandparents, deceased grandparents. So we took our money and we started, we honeymooned not too far from here up in Andover. The farmer and his wife, with whom we became quite friendly, sent us to a realtor in Hopkinton, no longer in business. But she took us around and she showed us three places in Warner. And the third place was this abandoned dairy farm that had been lived in by a failed artist and his wife who had divorced. And it had stood empty for 6 years. It was It was in very bad shape. Mm-hmm. The barn was falling. Well, you know what those places look like. But our pocketbooks reached around it. And I just loved it. I mean, the minute we started up that hill with its curves and came to the semi-top, it's halfway up the hill, because that's how the old settlers built. They knew enough not to build on top where all the wind was. The minute I saw it, I knew it was what I wanted. And so we bought it. And we kind of camped out in it. You know, we patched and managed and so on for several years. And then we decided to sell our house in suburban Boston and move up year-round. Mostly it was because of my garden. I kept coming up earlier to put my garden in and staying later because I wanted to harvest it. But Victor was ready, and he continued to commute to Boston a couple of days a week as a consultant to the engineering firm he had been with. And that was how it happened. And the land just grabbed me and never let go.
What was it about the land that grabbed you? Because it's on a hill. It's got rocks. The barn's falling down.
But it has trees. It had the possibility of pasture. It had the possibility of restoring part of the barn so we could have stalls, which is what we did eventually. We took the manure pit, which, you know, there had been cows on the first floor. You couldn't put horses there because the ceiling was too low. But we opened up the manure pit, and we actually ended up with 6 stalls. And you know, I've written that poem about the year we had 7 horses for 6 stalls, which is Jack. I couldn't be parted from this place. It totally absorbed me. The garden was so engaging, and I knew so little. Horse care, we also were pretty inexperienced, but we learned as we went. And I did not like my life in suburban Boston. I didn't like the social life. I didn't like the Saturday night dinner parties, the flash of silver and crystal. I was so glad to turn my back on all that and live a more natural life.
And your kids took to it too, right?
Oh, we maybe have 10 kids in sleeping bags on the floor weekends. It was a great way to chaperone without really being chaperones. They'd be out there digging in the it's escaping me, where the old foundations once, you know, digging to find old bottles and old tools and bits of china. And they were fascinated. They loved cutting brush. Oh, and anything with a chainsaw, which had to be closely supervised, that was heaven. So little by little, we managed. We had to put a new roof on almost immediately. And then we did start to restore the barn, and then we started with horses. And here we are, all these years later. Now my first foal is 31 years old, which is kind of unbelievable. And she has Cushing's disease, which is an end-of-life disease, but she's going to hang on. She's got a couple years left, I think. And we took in a friend's midlife gelding, just so we would have 3 in case one dies. So here I am with 3 horses. It's like I'll never be done.
I want to ask you a couple more questions about how living on the farm affected your writing, Maxine, but also remind you that you can join us if you want to talk to Maxine Kuman, talk about her poetry and how it may have moved you, or comment on some of the changes that Maxine has talked about, the growth in New Hampshire, some of the positive changes she's seen, growth in community activism and organic farming. If you've been affected by the rural life, too, as Maxine Kuman has been, we'd love to hear from you. The exchange number, 1-800-892-64. Your colleague Donald Hall, also a former poet laureate, has said that his farm has been his muse.
Yes.
True for you?
Yes, I think so. I think my muse is a little more physical than Don's. His is more reflective. I love his poetry. I mean, I think his book, After Jane Died, I can't read those poems without just weeping. Still, and I know them quite well. So, yes, I feel very strongly about Don's contribution as a poet to the country and certainly to New Hampshire. But as I said, I think his muse is somewhat more interior and mine is somewhat more exterior. I don't know exactly how to explain where these poems come from, but they bubble up and demand to be written.
Well, and they are exterior, many of them, in that they're about the stuff that you deal with every day.
Right.
You know, you're getting your fingernails dirty with
your
poetry, Maxine. Could you read one of those? It's a great example of you drawing inspiration from that dirt under your fingernails life on the farm. This is called Aristotle, and I want to let the audience know that it's from your newest book, Still to Mow.
Right. It's called Come, Aristotle. And it's about what you do every year, you know, as you sort of rotate. You don't grow your peas in the same row. You move them down a row. And so this is about that. On April 4, moving the pea fence to another row, we unearth 40 perfect parsnips that have spent the coldest winter since the 70s, condemned like leeches, Aristotle says, to suck up whatever sustenance may flow to them wherever they are stuck. Overlooked, our good luck. Aromatic poppets, pried from the black gold of old soil, dingier than cauliflower or pearls, we eat them braised with a little brown sugar. Pure, Aristotle. Come, philosopher, come to the table. Sit by my side.
They're dirty. They're delicious.
Yeah.
And you tie them to an ancient Greek philosopher.
Well, I was just lucky I came on that quote from Aristotle, who disdained any root vegetable at all.
Really?
Yeah, he wasn't just, giving it to parsnips, but he was probably condemning carrots and, and beets. Who knows?
Well, the poem also reflects something that I see so much in your work, Maxine, and that's inspiration, by the way. The seasons affect the rhythm of life on the farm. This is something that you and Donald Hall and others do so well. Have you noticed a change in the New Hampshire seasons, Maxine, that have been such an important part of your work?
I certainly have. For one thing, I'm swimming in the pond later and later. I think I made it to September 20th this year, and I think that's the latest. But that's a frivolous change. What I am noting is a much longer growing season. Here we are talking on the 24th of October, and we have not had a frost. We haven't had a hard frost. We had two things that sort of, evanesced and maybe touched the tops of some delicate leaves, but nothing that would take down the garden. The way in the olden days you'd get up in the morning and you'd say, thank God, there goes the garden.
I don't have to deal with it anymore.
Exactly. But no, that's really quite frightening.
And when does that get reflected in your poetry?
Well, maybe I haven't dealt with that yet. Maybe that's still to come.
Because the seasonal shift and rhythm, again, is so important to what you do.
Yeah.
Well, you can think about that.
I will.
You don't have to write poems to satisfy me or anybody else.
I should say that coming upon these parsnips unexpectedly reflects the kind of haphazard. I never kept a log of where I put things until Susie came into my life, Susie Colt, who's now my assistant. And she has a much more orderly mind. So she keeps account of how many broccoli soups we've put in the freezer, for example, and she keeps account of what has gone into what row and where we're planting the garlic this year as opposed to last year. So we'll never have that. We'll never be able to make that mistake again, to come upon the parsnips unexpectedly. I know exactly where they are now.
Takes away a little bit of the element of surprise.
It does a little. It makes me look like a more serious gardener. So I'm grateful for that.
Again, the number here in the exchange is 1-800-892-6477. Maxine, one more question about the portrayal of rural life. Again, the rhythms and rituals. have we reached a time where a good chunk of New Hampshire's population might read this and say, that's a pretty picture, but it really isn't relevant to me? I commute down to Boston every day. I'm a software engineer in Nashua. What do you think about that?
I'm tooling up to Lebanon to work at the hospital.
The very latest high-tech equipment, or I'm a recent refugee from, you know, Somalia. What do you think about that?
Well, I think that that's a very valid point. However, I also think that the poet has to do what the poet has to do.
And what the poet knows.
Now, I have to write about what I know. I can speculate about these other things, but I feel that I'm really tied to what I'm doing.
Is anyone writing sort of the poetry of that other life, that more urban or suburban, fast-paced Granite State
life? I think in a way Charlie Simic does. Although he's rather an absurdist, still, I think he's...
He's the new poet laureate,
right?
Also from New Hampshire.
Yeah, there's
something in the water here?
That's exactly what I said when I was asked.
So he's doing more contemporary.
Well, I think he just is a more... he has a more global outlook. And you know, he came here as a refugee, as a teenager from Yugoslavia. And here he is writing brilliantly in English, and that I find fascinating.
To the point where he's the poet laureate.
Yes.
It's pretty impressive.
Yes,
I'm just waiting for poetry about, you know, I was stuck in a traffic jam.
Yes.
And here's what I saw on the faces of the people. I was working on a project and my computer crashed. You know, that type of poetry. As much as we appreciate and love the rural poetry, too.
Yeah. Well, as I think I told you, I just did a master class for... the New Hampshire Writers Project, and I had 12 women sitting around the table, and I saw some really handsome, fine poems. There was one poem, interestingly enough, it was a torture poem. The 11 others all had a rural setting or a rural intent.
Is that the ghost of Robert Frost looking over our shoulders? We'll talk about that after a short break, and maybe our audience will chime in on that, too. The exchange number, 1-800-892-6477. You're listening to The Exchange on NHPR.
My name is Ann Kulig, and I live in Plymouth. There are so many times in life where we really are focused inward, and we only think about our own pain, our own suffering, our own issues, what we have to do tomorrow, what we have to cook for dinner tonight. And what public radio, and in particular New Hampshire Public Radio, does for me is allow me to focus outside myself, looking at the issues that may be happening around the country, around the world, people who are truly suffering, people who are truly facing some difficult situations in their lives. And it sort of provides a reality check for me.
This is New Hampshire Public Radio, and it's our fall membership drive. The number to call to support the station is 1-888-805-6477 or at nhpr.org. And there is a matching opportunity right now. If New Hampshire Public Radio gets $15,000 in contributions before noon, we will receive $5,000 from several friends in the Keene area of the NHPR. That's fantastic. I'm Lisa Peeks. I'm here with Brady Carlson. And Brady, just under $8,000 to go to meet the challenge.
All right.
$7,850 to be exact.
All right. So that means that listeners like you are pledging their support fast and furious, and it is fast to make a contribution, but it makes a big difference. Your support helps pay the costs of bringing you shows like The Exchange, from researching topics by producers to doing interviews and, of course, hearing the conversation on the air. Part of what I do on The Exchange is help with the website of things. So when a guest like Maxine Kumin is in the studio, I stop in and take a few photos, and then I post those on our website for you to see. I also work on the 25 and 25 side of things for the profiles that you have on the website that take things a little bit further. You can help keep NHPR strong with your contribution and offset some of those costs by calling 1-888-805-6477.
You've probably heard us talking about the three $500 gift certificates we're giving away at the end of the drive. Well, word of mouth is getting around, and some of the independent bookstores all over the state are jumping in to further help NHPR reach this goal. There's a $500 gift certificate to the independent bookstore of your choice. Maxine Kuman, for example, lives in Warner. There's Main Street Bookends over in Warner. That might be a choice for you if you're in that area. But a lot of these bookstores are saying, yeah, we'll kick in an additional $100. So that's a great value. You're somebody who likes to learn. You're somebody who could really appreciate this. With your pledge, you'll help NHPR get to this $15,000 goal. You'll be entered in the drawing for the book certificate, and you'll feel good knowing that you're supporting the station. Call 1-888-805-6477 or pledge at nhpr.org.
And you know that the reason to support NHPR is the same reason why you listen. Because you like to learn, as Lisa said, because you like to be well-informed, not just about what goes on here in New Hampshire in the news and in politics, but about the arts, about culture, about what happens on global issues like climate change, issues like healthcare or education. The Exchange tackles these topics every day, and they're able to do it in a unique way because of contributions from listeners, emails, phone calls, comments, and questions. Well, not only do you help that show be what it is, but you help NHPR as a contributing member by calling 1-888-805-6477. Show your support right now.
The response to this $15,000 matching opportunity has been fantastic this morning. Thank you so much to everyone who's called. We're getting responses from all over the place. Stefan Koska of Shelburne Falls, Mass. Is a brand new member. He listens every single morning and figured he should support New Hampshire Public Radio. We also heard from the Reverend Eleanor McLaughlin from Berlin, who says she's glad to hear there is someone else who listens to the BBC at night. So thanks to those people. They all contributed. What's going to happen is that when NHPR gets $15,000 by noon, we'll get an additional $5,000 from friends in Keene. So go to the website and pledge there at nhpr.org.
Or call 1-888-805-6477. And of course, this hour, as a special incentive, we're giving away Maxine Kuman's latest book of poems. It's called Still to Mow. That's available at the $75 level. So you, if you're enjoying this conversation with Maxine Kuman, one of New Hampshire's most celebrated poets, you can pick up a copy of her latest collection, as well as support news and information here on The Exchange and on New Hampshire Public Radio. You'll also be helping us get closer to that $5,000 in additional money by calling 1-888-805-6477 or by pledging online at nhpr.org. And thanks so much.
Additional support for New Hampshire Public Radio comes from Spalding Youth Center, helping children and youth with autism, neurological, and behavioral challenges achieve their full potential online at spaldingyouthcenter.org. And the McLean Law Firm offering congratulations to Opera New Hampshire for 43 years of presenting professional opera. This is New Hampshire Public Radio.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Thursday on The Exchange, we play back for you the latest in our Writers on a New England Stage series with documentary producer Ken Burns. He discussed his latest film, The War, and answered questions from a live audience. Join us for that tomorrow morning at 9. Right now, we're talking with poet Maxine Kuman about her career and getting her writer's view on how New Hampshire has changed and evolved over the past quarter century. It's our 25 and 25 series today on The Exchange, where we celebrate 25 years of New Hampshire Public Radio. The phone number, 1-800-892-6477. If you'd like to talk with Maxine Kuman about her work or some of the changes she's seen, you can join us at 1-800-892-6477. Maxine, let's go to our callers now. And Elsa's calling from Antrim. Hi, Elsa. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi. Good to talk with you. I'm a paying member, and I love your show.
Thanks, Elsa.
And I love Maxine Kuman's work. Long time ago, my friend's mare was pregnant, and I got a hold of In Country and read all of your essays, especially enjoyed the one about twins that made me very nervous that she might be having twins. But I came to start reading your poetry, and I've never been much into poetry, but I love yours.
Well, what is it, Elsa, that makes it accessible for you?
Oh, just the subject matter, you know, farming and raising animals and being so close to animals. I've never been able to own a horse, but I've always wanted to.
You know, and this is sort of what you said earlier, Maxine, about, you know, your poetry being very kind of hands-on.
Right. Yes, my exterior muse, as opposed to a reflective interior muse. Well, I'm glad. I'm really glad you like the horse poems and the farming poems, too.
And people still relate to this book that you did in, I think it was 87?
Yeah.
In Deep Country Essays?
Yeah.
And still people talk about that and reflect on it because it offered such a poetic diary of sort of daily life and garden and how it overwhelms you and and so forth. Thanks for the call, Elsa. Again, 1-800-892-6477. 1-800-892-NHPR. One change, though, that we've heard about Maxine in New Hampshire, in addition to the ones that you noted, is that people don't get outdoors as much. Hunting and fishing is down. We talked with Richard Louvre earlier this week about how children don't go outside as much as they used to. You have a poem in your newest book, Still to Mow, about hunting called Hunting Season. Could you read that for us, please,
and
then we'll talk about it.
It's not very flattering, no. This is what we see. This is the residue. Hunting season. Target practice in the gravel pit escalates once the date is set to orange vests and whiffs of deer, immoderately helped by beer. Yarded by stream, snagged in brush, Coors and Miller, bronzed and crushed, glint through fallen leaves and snow to say no matter where we go on trails that plunge vertiginous, their litter has preceded us.
So it's kind of a, if I could say, call it a diss on hunting season because of all the beer cans?
Yeah, it's a diss. I mean, everybody says that it's not the in-state hunters who litter, and that's probably true. But I think it is the out-of-staters who come, and it's an all-day beer party. They've been drinking on the way up. They're drinking in the woods, and they just drop their cans and drop their brown bag sacks of lunch and whatever else. Also, and this is the worst of all, when they do get a deer, they don't do what they're supposed to do. Often they just cut out the haunches, they take what they want, and they leave the rest of the animal.
Really? You've
come
across that?
Well, my dog brings home a deer leg. I know that it's a deer that hasn't been properly brought out and tagged.
What have you noticed, Maxine, about people, especially younger people, getting outside? This seems to be a change that at least the folks at Fish and Game have noticed.
That they're not as many.
No, they're not interested.
Even though we have these wonderful trails, the Forest Society right here in Concord has beautiful trails, and there are beautiful trails along the river and so on. And in Warner, all up through the Mink Hills, there are places to hike. I haven't noticed it personally because I see in our community, for example, the conservation group is running all these wonderful fall hikes. And they list the degree of difficulty, and they get a big group to go. So I'm not aware of it. I also would have to say that I think one of the nice things about moving to a town like Warner or Bradford or Sutton or whatever, is the safety factor. Parents can feel relaxed about letting their kids out. Kids in these communities are still free to move through the town here and there on their bikes. Whereas in the city, this is really a problem. And kids are kept indoors just because of the danger of letting them be out.
Speaking of hunting, there's another poem in your 1982 book that shows you have nothing per se against killing animals. I'm not going to ask you to read it, but Maxine, this is a poem about woodchucks.
Oh, right. That infamous poem.
And we were looking back at some of your 1982 poetry, again, to reflect on 25 and 25. And we came across woodchucks where you hoped to gas them.
Yes.
It didn't work. And then you got some pleasure shooting them point blank.
Yes. Well, when we first took on this old farm, it was really, it was just riddled with woodchucks. And the what we wanted to be pastures were very unsafe because they were full of woodchuck holes. And horses step in a woodchuck hole and break a leg.
Yeah, that's
so
terrible for a horse.
We did. And then after we extirpated the woodchucks, we do still have them, but not in that quantity, the porcupines took on... That was another problem because we had a dog who just pursued them and went back for vengeance after he'd been anesthetized and had 56 quills taken out.
And oh, gosh.
You know that story. So we went after the porcupines, too.
You say that a former pacifist had no problem getting out that gun and going after the woodchuck.
Yes, I'm not proud of that at all, but it's a fact.
And a poem.
Yes.
Let's go back to our callers. This is Cynthia in Goshen. Hi, Cynthia. You're on The Exchange with Maxine Kuhman.
Hi. I've just recently taken over as the new librarian of the Olive G. Pettis Library in Goshen. And my concern, not necessarily with people not getting out in nature so much, because our rural community really has very active people in our garden clubs, people with their own little home farms and things like this. I'm seeing less and less people read, less and less of the children and the teenagers come into the libraries and grab a book, whether a book of fiction or short stories or poetry. And while I have several events planned to try and bring the general public in, I'm just curious what Maxine's take is on this. Who do you see reading, and those who are falling away, how can we get them back?
Cynthia, it's a great question, and good to hear from a librarian. Go ahead, Maxine.
Well, I agree. I mean, I think this is a huge problem. Whatever you can do at your library to bring in a general readership will be wonderful. I think it's, I hate to say it's the electronic age, it's the computer, it's the DVDs, but I really think that this is it. Kids are more stimulated by what they see on the screen than they are by what they're going to get out of a book, unless they're encouraged by very sensitive teachers and librarians. I think you can do something to stem the tide, but I think you're not going to ever deal with it completely.
I want to ask you one more question, Maxine. Cynthia, thanks for that call. We've asked all our 25 and 25 guests, and by the way, thanks for being part of this series.
My
pleasure. Appreciate it. To celebrate our 25th birthday here at NHPR, we've asked everybody what Granite Stater or Staters have most inspired you. You said in your questionnaire, which is on the website, nhpr.org, that one of your key inspirations was the poet Robert Frost. No big surprise. In your new book, Still to Mow, there's a poem inspired by Frost. It's called Last Poem.
The final poem.
The final poem. Excuse me.
Right.
Excuse me. Could you just set it up for us briefly and then read it to us, please?
Yes. I knew Frost. I shouldn't say I knew him. I was acquainted with him at Breadloaf. And in his final years, he would come down to the Breadloaf campus quite regularly and hang around. Or he certainly gave readings as well. And I think this was one of the last readings that he must have been in the early 60s.
Wow, so you saw him sitting there reading.
Yes, this is exactly what happened.
And Maxine, and I hate to do this to you, in the interest of time, could you read us sort of your favorite part from that poem?
Well, I'll just start it. Breadloaf, late August, the chemistry of a New England fall already inviting the swamp maples to flare. Magisterial in the white wicker rocker, Robert Frost at rest after giving a savage reading, holding nothing back, his rage at dying, not yet, as he barged his chair forth, then back. Don't sit there mumbling in the shadows. Call yourselves poets, all but a handful scattered. Fate rearranged us happy few at his feet. He rocked us until midnight. I took away these close-lipped dicta. Look up from the page. Pause between poems. Say something about the next one. Otherwise, the audience will coast. They can't take in half of what you're giving them. Reaching for the knob of his cane, he rose and flung this exit line. Make every poem your final poem.
Is that how you write? Make every poem your final poem? Do you think about that?
I hope so. I would like to. I think that's the best approach.
That's the goal.
Yeah, that's the goal, right?
This has been a real pleasure. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me, Laura.
Poet Maxine Kuhman helping us celebrate 25 years of New Hampshire Public Radio on the air. This is The Exchange on NHPR.
I'm Betsy Gardella, president of New Hampshire Public Radio. Over the last year, NHPR has brought you news coverage that's kept you in touch with the world and talk shows that have kept you engaged. Your donation right now helps keep this vital service strong for everyone. Please make your contribution today. Call 1-888-805-NHPR or visit us online at nhpr.org. And thanks.
As we heard a moment ago from Maxine Kuhman talking about Robert Frost, don't sit back in the shadows. NHPR needs your help right now to meet an important goal. You can help by calling 1-888-805-6477 or by pledging online at nhpr.org. I'm Brady Carlson here with Lisa Peeks. And Lisa, we have a goal this morning to get a total of $15,000 raised to get an additional $5,000 from some generous NHPR listeners. Just $7,300 left to go, so we're well past the halfway point. Your call right now can help us set up that home stretch toward our deadline at noon.
That is great news, but that means that we've got 2 hours left to raise $7,380 in order to get that $5,000. So your calls really will help at 1-888-805-6477. Join Kathleen Puricello from Westminster, West Vermont. She's a VPR member, but she listens to NHPR all the time. She loves Laura Kanoy and Diane Rehm, and on Sunday she listens to The Thistle and Shamrock, and she has just become a brand new NHPR member. How about you? 1-888-805-6477 or nhpr.org.
Or maybe it's time to renew your membership. You've contributed in the past. Now is the perfect time to help get an additional value because of that matching money that's on the table right now. An additional $5,000 up for grabs. We can pull it down with your help, and your help is what makes it all possible. Show your support right now and help pay for programs like The Exchange by calling 1-888-805-6477 and making your contribution.
But there are only